Bullpen Session. I'm Patrick Lillis. Glad you're here. Glad you're listening. Excited to share this episode with you. Conversation with my friend, playwright Jake Brash. Known Jake since 2011 when I was fortunate enough to direct a play of his. He was a high school student and submitted a play to Young Playwrights Inc. and was a finalist for their national competition, and grateful to reconnect a couple years later at the end of his time at NYU, and stayed and formed a friendship with him since. And it's just been great. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to Jake is he had just gotten back from the Alliance Theater in Atlanta, where they were workshopping a play of his, The Reservoir, which also was, you'll hear in the conversation, developed at Denver Theater Center, and in 2025 is scheduled to be produced at those two theaters and one other major regional theater. And just really proud of his incredible creativity that is maintained and stayed in his work and freedom while also doing the work and getting the discipline and developing his work and having it showcased in great institutions across the country. So that is exciting. And the conversation is great. And it's a lot about his process and how it got from, you know, encouragement early on to self-producing to other doors and larger communities opening up for him. And it's a really valuable conversation. And I appreciate it because, you know, one of the things I think about with the farm is cultivating early career artists. And it's not just cultivating their talent, but also, you know, cultivating how do you get them to the next step? How do you get them in that conversation of and an awareness of a wider community who can take their work, whether it's playwriting, directing, acting, design, producing, to the next level? And very excited to see Jake getting to the next level and excited to share with you the conversation of how that's happening and creatively what is happening. And with that, play ball.
You know, it feels good actually coming back to it this time after a year. I was like, oh, you know, a lot that I was in the weeds with around, especially like the roles of narration. It's a direct address play. And it has some sort of wonky, and I think wonderful roles to it, but there was hearing it, I was like, oh, actually I hear it differently. And, you know, I've been at Juilliard over the last year and it was nice to be like, oh, I'm a better writer than I was when I wrote this play. And without breaking the thing, I was like, I want to go back in there and actually fine tune the thing. So I worked on it a lot more than I thought I was going to.
When you say, oh, I'm better, is it just time? Is it just practice? Or is it the collaborations? What's done it? What do you think's taken you to the next level of artistry that you think you're at?
I think it's all of those things. I think mostly it's continuing to write and work on plays with smart people. And that comes with applying for every silly thing that comes up and getting one out of 400 and getting the chance to bring a play somewhere and to work on it. I mean, if I had to point at one thing, it would be the ability to revise and revise well as the thing that I think has sort of gotten me to the next level, is the ability to look at something and be like, okay, what is this thing trying to do? Separate my sort of impulse, and a lot of times like an impulse that I find delightful or terrifying or bad, and be like, okay, well, what is here on the page? What is being presented? How can I actually make that thing more of what it wants to be? And I think part of the problem, I think, as a playwright is that there's a lot of, you know, there's, it's a scarcity problem. You have so few opportunities to get yourself up that I think you can feel precious, or I'll speak from I can feel precious about the thing. And then getting to the other side of being like, okay, wait a minute, actually, you know, this thing could be better. This thing, the questions that actors and directors and dramaturgs and theaters are asking are not attacks. You know, everyone wants this thing to be good. We're working in a collaborative art form. How can I make my good thing better? I feel like that has been the question that's kind of gotten me to the next level.
And where do you think you found the space to ask that question? Because I know for a little while you were putting up your own plays and putting them up pretty quickly, right? And what do you think got you? Because I think what you're saying is right. And actually, you and I have talked a couple of times about that. And when it's like, oh, you have to rewrite and you have to be critical. Or and also open, like you're saying, to other people. Nobody's attacking your play. They're all giving, they're asking questions and input because they want it to be good. What do you think allowed that to happen? When did you realize, like, oh, it doesn't have to be scarcity, and it doesn't have to be, if it doesn't happen right now, it's not going to happen.
I think it takes a tremendous amount of self-belief and self-love to be like, my play is not me. I am not there. This is not a representation of like how good or not good I am. And to be able to just get space, it's kind of, I don't mean to be so like metaphysical about it, but like to get some space from the thing. And to be like, okay, it's not working yet, but it could work. And I started as an actor, right? But my world comes from performance. And for me, what drove me so nuts about that, I thought I was pretty good, but not great at it. And the reason that I wasn't great at it was because I couldn't get enough distance from the work and myself. And being able to write a play and being able to hold it in my hands, it was so clear that this is something that I'm working on. It is not me. And I think that is something I return to and return to and return to. And that's harder to do when you don't have other people saying, like, this is great. This is something that we want to work on. These are opportunities to work on this thing and make it better. When you're just stuck with your computer in a room trying to figure out what do I have to offer to the world. It's really hard to get to the point of being like, this thing that I'm making is not me, So I think partially it's just a lot of I've had a lot of luck lately in getting chances to work on things, which has allowed for that space, which has allowed for me to take risks and try things and make things that I'm genuinely curious about. As opposed to feeling like I have to be precious and offer exactly what I want to say.
I'm going to jump. I want to jump just to a little earlier in the process. Just what did it do? I didn't know that you self-produced and you produced before. There's a great play, Salutations, I'm Creative Dave, which was very interesting and very successful self-production. And I'm curious, what did self-producing along the journey, just because it's earlier in the journey, did you, it was necessary for you to do, and what do you think you learned from that, or what was the benefit of doing that?
I think the benefit of doing that is, I think I've seen a lot of folks wait for someone to say yes. Like, just it was so empowering to be like, I'm not going to wait on this one. I know I have something on my hands that I want to make. I know that I can direct the shit out of it. I'm going to get my friends who are all going to be past age inappropriate because they're all in their 20s and nobody's making any money and we're putting it up at a tiny theater. And that was the play that that I'll just say that play is about a robot writing an American family drama about its family. It's a housekeeping robot who's been reprogrammed to be creative. It is an absolutely batshit play, out of its mind. I wasn't getting a lot of success around folks biting at it when I was sending it off to a bunch of places. So I was just like, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna put it up. I'm going to raise a bunch of money through a hideously embarrassing Indiegogo campaign, which every self-producing theater artist knows a lot about. And I did it at the Alchemical with dear, dear, dear friends, and we had a ton of fun. And the thing was harrowing to get it up, money-wise, doubt-wise, like have I bitten off more than I can chew? Can I get butts in seats? Being in my own like promotional apparatus. I don't want to do it anymore, but I'm glad that I did it. I'm glad that I did it because that was the play that got me into Young Blood at EST, right? Which was sort of the beginning of institutional support. I mean, except for the farm, which has been there for me since the very beginning, which I will happily and gleefully talk about on your podcast, Patrick. But
I know about that, so I can talk about that anytime. But I am interested. No, well, that's interesting because also you put that play up, the one Salutations. You put it up a second time, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there was enthusiasm, and Alchemical came back and said, you know, we'd like to have you back. And it's funny when you say, I don't want to do it again, which I understand 100%. Mm-hmm. But there is a benefit to doing it because there's something about knowing, not only knowing, I was going to say for other people to know that you're a producible playwright. You're a playwright who should be produced and seen as produced. There's some value in that, in people recognizing that. And there's something value for you knowing that. And then knowing like, oh, that's, you know, being in a community of EST and knowing like, oh, I'd like to be the writer and not the producer, you know?
Right.
And finding that community. And what does EST do for you, the Youngbloods?
Oh, gosh. I mean, like that group has changed my life in almost every way imaginable. I mean, so EST, for those who don't know, Youngblood is a group of playwrights under 30. It's now 31. In the pandemic, they made it 31. That is a sort of very loosely organized group of friends who all go to this theater on the extreme west side in the 50s. And once a month they do a brunch, which is short plays. EST sort of, their currency is short plays. They're famous for a marathon of one acts that they do every other year. And we meet once a week. I mean, no longer, I'm too old now, but we met once a week and read a play of someone in the group and talked about it, talked about things that we're seeing in town. But honestly, the thing that has been the most revelatory is all of my best friends now are folks who are trying to do the same thing I am. All of the quote unquote competition are people that I genuinely love and I'm rooting for. And that's just a huge moment in an impossible business where like even those who are the most successful aren't making any money as playwrights, you know, to be in a group of folks who are all trying to do this incredibly batshit chaotic thing called being a professional playwright. They're my friends and I love them and I get to learn through osmosis. I mean, that getting to watch people's process through how they're chewing through their own plays and how folks write, whether they bring in fragments or whether they bring in full drafts, how they think about what they do and how they do it. I've learned so much. And I just also have made a lot of friends. And I'm all about, you know, baking things and bringing them to hungry playwrights.
And that's how you build the friendships?
Yeah, exactly. You got cookies and bread. You get them through carbs. You get them through carbs, and then later on, you trap them in a room and you force them to produce your plays. You hear that, kids?
Now I'm really struck by that because I'm thinking community is always important. You know, like when you mentioned the farm, right? And at first, there's this room of playwrights of different levels that you're working with, and then meeting a couple, but there is something. And that's vital, right? Because that community is the ones who recognizes that a play like a batshit crazy play like Salutations needs to be produced and they're going to get in behind with you. But then there's something about the next level of community, like the Youngbloods, where you're like, oh, everybody here is dedicating their life to this and mm-hmm. and in an honest pursuit of a career.
Right.
And I think that friendship is also, I think it's interesting because it really is a friendship. Like I'm thinking about the Alliance when you said, oh, I went and there's this other group of writers for whatever finalists that it is. You're all trying to do the same thing and it's not competition. You know,
it's not.
It's not. And we, you know, that's scarcity mentality is so hard to let go of because there's still scarcity. It's still hard to get your play produced. But it's not competition because your play is going to get produced because somebody has to produce that play.
Right.
And it's not because they picked one of four. It's like, no, that's the play for that play. And maybe the other three plays will find their home somewhere else.
100%. Absolutely. I mean, I have no idea why and how theaters program plays. Even as my play is being programmed and I kind of get to see a little bit behind the curtain. Who knows, right? Like actually one of the other things working on the Reservoir, going back to it, listening to it, I was like, two things. One, oh, this play is good. This is a good play, and I see why this is being produced. And this play is no better than any of my other plays, also. This is just a Jake play. This, you know what I mean? And this thing that has sort of gotten a lot of institutional attention, I'm proud of it and I'm glad it does. And I, you know, the confident and not egotistical side of myself is like, I see why it has. But in another sense, who knows why things get plucked, right? Who knows why things get programmed? And oftentimes it's a chaotic, sort of amazing lottery winning process. But, you know, I feel like often from the outside, even for me, when I see like what gets programmed, I have this idea that it is the sort of the plays that magically were great, right? And it's just like our whole world. The meritocracy like does not exist, right? It is way more chaotic and confusing. And I'd like to believe that the better playwrights and the better plays get more attention, but who knows, right? And I think being in a having playwrights all around me writing great things and getting to read them and getting to process them and getting to work on them has been such a great lesson in like that doesn't exist. Who knows why things get programmed, but I know why I think something is great. I know why I think someone is great. I know why I think the way that they work on it is great. And getting to be in process with everybody and remember that that's what we're all doing has been a balm for a lot of the fear that comes with trying to make it.
You know, and an interesting thing is though, what do you feel the conversation is like? Because Reservoir is getting produced, right? I mean, hopefully this will be announced before the podcast is released in 10 days. But it's getting produced at a couple of regional theaters. And what is that conversation like where you feel that somebody's connecting to your play that, like you say, oh, I don't know why it got picked. Or a play gets picked, and I understand that too. It seems so random in the chaos. But there has to be a conversation where people are talking about your play that it's a different conversation than another play that they just think is interesting writing that you've done, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think specifically with the Reservoir, what happened was I accidentally wrote a Rorschach play. I wrote about my grandparents and how there was a cross-generational connection there in a not necessarily straightforward, logical way. And by writing an incredibly specific play about my experiences with that, I accidentally stumbled on something that a lot of folks feel, which is the intergenerational connection or lack thereof in their families. And people really see themselves in it. And, you know, I've had people come up to me after readings of that play and say things like, this really reminded me of my uncle who was a veteran and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, that had nothing to do with my play. Like what you just said. Nothing is in there. But for whatever reason, it created space in you to look at things that you don't usually look at. So that's my theory as to why that play kind of specifically stuck out. I mean, there's a couple other things that, which is that that play has been given a lot of support. You know, I think the miracle is oftentimes the first person who gives a play a development process because it is sloppy, right? And so I think that play has also just been finely tuned and that it's kind of unimpeachable at this point. Which helps as to why that one gets chosen. But ultimately, I don't know, Patrick. I don't know. I don't know why this one and not other ones. There are some specific other ones where I'm like, oh, well, you're not doing this play because there's like a, you know, naked 85-year-old clown in it who says fuck 32 times within the first 3 minutes. Like, I get why they're not doing that play, you know, at a major regional theater. But sometimes I'm like, here, I have something for you. This is, why not this? And they're like, eh, you know, who knows, right? Like, our tastes. And I think when I write the worst plays are when I'm trying to write something that everyone's gonna love, right? Like, I did not write The Reservoir from that perspective at all.
No, when you started that play, you know what? I'm going to back up actually, because I'm going to take a little journey with that play. Is you wrote it for a Sloan commission. Do you apply, or does EST come to you and ask you to apply? How does a Sloan? I know a couple people who've done them with different theaters, and I'm just curious, is it you asking to do it, or does somebody open the opportunity for that to happen?
So the Sloan program at EST, and this is feels important because these kind of opportunities I feel like are few and far between, is a truly open submission. So if you just go to the EST website, if it's not open, you can shoot them an email, and then what it is a one-page pitch, which you come up with your scientific sort of idea, and it's both science or technology, and you pitch your play in a page and go from there, and then you know, you get they reach out to you if they're interested in hearing more about it, or you just get a commission. So that's how that specific process works. It's always nice to be able to talk about those opportunities because so often, it's like, well, how to like with some of these festivals or off-Broadway reading series, it's like, who knows how they pick their place.
And then, in this play, The Reservoir, right, came out of the Sloan, you do the pitch, you've written it, and then is this the play you applied to Juilliard with?
It is, yes.
And the time that you got into Juilliard, how many times did you
It
apply to Juilliard?
oh God, Patrick. I think four. I think four. Yeah.
And so this is the one you applied to it, you got in, and then one of the things I'm interested in also is just because there is, like you said, oh, the myth of talking about like how are these opportunities provided and some are you don't understand. It's like, I think about your play getting to the Denver Play Summit and getting to the Alliance, but that happens because, Sloan at EST. You get into Juilliard, and then Juilliard ha gives you either opens a door to representation, or it opens a door to meetings, right? I mean, because that's how because if you didn't have that step, it would be a lot harder to get these other major regional theaters to be in conversation with them, right?
100%. Yes. I mean, even that was not a straight line, right? After I got in, I mean, just specific, I mean, I have no reason not to be transparent. Like after I got into Juilliard, I still had to do a lot of work on my end to get representation, right? And I think specifically in this moment right now, it's hard to, you know, A3 just shut down a big agency. I mean, representation is a very tricky conversation right now. And that's a whole other can of worms, but I had to work hard to get representation. I got representation. And then the way that the Reservoir made it to the Denver Center is that Shelley Butler was also repped by my agent,
She's
and
the director, right?
she's the director of the Reservoir. And she read the play when she just had him send her a full slate because she was reading things and just sort of stumbled on and was like, yes, this, and pitched it to Denver. So it sort of was like, you know, it's not a straight line, right? Like, even, yes, it probably wouldn't have happened if I hadn't have gotten into Juilliard, but it wasn't like then they set up any conversations for me, right?
Now, you know what I'm addressing is that idea of because I think of Salutations, I'm Creative Dave, which was an incredible success for self-producing, right? And I think there's a f an understandable frustration by a playwright who does something like that and then thinks like, well, why isn't this play getting done everywhere? And the audience response, because I've seen it a lot, right? You do indie theater in New York and you get produced. And I know a lot of playwrights who get produced at a certain level or self-produce and they have success. And then you're wondering like, well, why not? And what does, and then you think about like, well, what does, and I'm not saying Juilliard because it's Juilliard, right? But what does, like you went to the Alliance because they give an award to people in the MFA program. And it's like, right. There is something about the institutional support, like an EST,
mm-hmm.
which starts to put you in conversations that are bigger, where all of a sudden you don't know Shelley Butler, but right. you have 2 degrees of separation and they're able to read your play and they have a relationship or an entree into Denver. And I just think it's just tracking, like, I think it's valuable to track that, like, oh, that's how that progression happens. Because if there wasn't institutional and communal support, like you talked about with the writers who you love, who are your friends working, you know, it's hard to go from I'm doing it in the white box at Alchemical to I'm doing it at Denver and I'm doing it at the Alliance, you know. And that can't happen. That's almost, I don't want to say impossible, but it's really difficult to do on your own.
100%. Well, it is impossible to do on your own, right? Like being a playwright is an impossible thing to do on your own from every measurable angle. You're in a collaborative art form that requires time and people and money and institutional support and everything under the sun, right? Like you know, people love to be like, well, write a book if you don't want to do that. But even people who write books have editors and publishers and a whole wide world of like difficulty with getting things out there. I think writing the play is only a part of it. And hearing, you know, what you're saying sort of around when you start getting into EST or getting into Juilliard and getting to these places where you're just in a larger conversation, where my mind goes is like, okay, but I had 7 years plus of being like, I wanted to be a capital P playwright in the world. This is what I want. And I believe that I'm good at it before of really trying to kick down doors and applying to every single goddamn thing, you know, on the like New York playwrights blog, right, of the person who's conglomerating all of the opportunities before I really started to have traction, right? And what happened in that time was getting to know who my deepest collaborators are. It was getting to meet folks here and there, and it was my writing getting better. But I really think it's just endurance. I mean, I really think if you're working on your craft and you're hanging in there, that's the best shot you can give yourself.
Well, and there's a secondary thing that you said, you know, because there is working on your craft and applying to things.
Totally, 100%.
You know, and I looked on your website, and it's funny that you talked about the carbs because I saw that you're a sourdough.
Oh, yes.
Aficionado, but which probably came out of the pandemic, I'm sure.
I mean, give me a little bit more credit than that. I have been a sourdough girl for far longer, but I did go hard in the pandemic.
But what I noticed, what I was reminded of when you said 7 years, is that we met in 2011,
right,
when you were a finalist for the national competition of the Young Playwrights Inc., a national organization from Denver. And I do think, because I don't want to take it away, it's not like, oh, I did this, and that's why, you know, how many years did you apply to Juilliard and things like that, is because, you know, you were pursuing acting, as you said, in college, but, you know, started writing and applied to a national thing when you were 17.
Yeah. Right.
And I think that commitment is, I don't want to gloss over that, because I think the 7 years you talked about are really important, of you dedicating and committing and working and getting better is real.
Yeah. I mean, looking back, like going back towards what sort of started the train, right? For me, it was at Curious Theater Company, which is the small, amazing theater company in Denver, and Dee Covington, who ran this young playwrights program during the summer, for a few weeks, playwrights under 18 would come hang out and write together and eventually put up their plays. But she like brought in, I had no idea at the time, she brought in Annie Baker and Adam Bach and Issa Davis to do like workshops with us, and really sort of believed in us before we even understood anything about what we were doing, right? And I feel like every successful person that I know has had one person, and usually many people, who do that. And for me, it was her and then you, because she had me apply to that competition and you were my director and you were like, this is good, it could be really good. And talk to me like an adult. And then, you know, then it was EST, then it was Juilliard, and having folks that see what you might be capable of without talking down to you, it's huge, right? Like, that's really where, when I stopped to be like, how was I able to commit my life to this? It's that more than anything.
Yeah, and I think I hear that and I go, oh, I love that Issa Davis and Annie Baker and all those, you know, Adam Bach, like, came, that they brought them, because I think about you were a college co-lab playwright, and going to talk to, one of the things is talking to the students when you're there. And, you know, I just had a conversation with a playwright about, you know, what's the benefit of it? And I think, well, the benefit is you hear a working to going to a college, you know, and doing the 1 hour conversation or whatever. And it's like, oh, the benefit is you might inspire something.
Right.
In an 18 year old, just because they hear a different voice. And all of those voices are very, those three people are very unique. Can't say very unique, but unique writer. They all have their own voice. And I can see that they could inspire you to then write, it free you up to be okay to write in your voice.
100%. I mean, that's something that I actually think about, is looking back at that time, and I'd be like, I would be shocked if any of the three of those playwrights remember anything from that time. Totally shocked. Sorry to segue before I even tell the story, but I was also just thinking about when I came for the New Playwrights Inc. Festival, and you were my director, and you, the two people in my very heavy-handed play about a man who attempts to kill his wife by drowning her in the Hudson River, you know, which is like an 18-year-old's idea of what is good.
Of marriage.
What the hell? It was Sid Williams and Kelly Ray O'Donnell, right? And Sid was in my play at Lab last year that you also directed. And I said to him, I was like, you know, you really helped me early on sort of understand how to work and how to work with an actor in the room. And he was like, what? And I was like, you were in my play when I was 18. He's like, no, I wasn't. I was like, yes, you were. He had no recollection. So I think oftentimes, like, looking back at these, I remember Adam Bach brought in a whole bag of fruit, and he had grapes that he arranged in certain patterns on the floor, like groups of three and then one separate, and was like, what story does this tell? You know, and then his big thing at the end was that he brought out a cantaloupe and dropped it on a grape and crushed it. And it was like devastating. It was just like such an amazing theatrical moment that had been created because of how long we had been thinking about the grapes. Like, we had started to care about these grapes in ways that we didn't know. And it, like, I look back on that as being like, right, okay, I totally get it. I would be shocked if he remembers that as being important. So when I go, like for the College Collaboration Project, into colleges, into high schools, talking with younger folks, I taught you also helped me teach a group of seventh graders over the pandemic playwriting. I kept coming back to, like, remember how huge this was for you. Remember how this was absolutely everything for you. It feels so important to be doing that work now on my own.
Yeah, well, it was huge, and so funny to, that teaching experience of teaching fifth graders playwriting was huge for me. And it's funny, I don't usually, I get a little distracted on the pod thinking about that, but the one kid who's wanted stage directions to be a granola bar or whatever, right?
Right. I mean, oh, I'm obsessed with, I really hope she's still writing. Writing from the perspective of a granola bar, and I mean, there were these kids, you know, watching these seventh graders be able to, I would suggest, like, you know, think outside the box, and they'd be like, okay, I'm gonna add a talking granola bar into my play. And I was like, great. And just no self-consciousness around that. You know, there was another kiddo that wrote, I had been like, write what's actually going on with you. And her cat was had escaped and had not returned. And her play was literally like 14 scenes. Like scene one, you know, Emily comes home from school, and Emily and mom, Emily, has the cat come home? No. Scene two, mom, has the cat come home? I'm sorry, no. Scene three, has the cat come home? Not today. Scene four, mom, do you think someone else brought the cat in? Maybe, honey, maybe someone else has the cat. Scene five, is the cat home? No, it's not. Scene six, do you think the cat is dead? I mean, truly was like, this was the play. I was like, this is fucking iconic. Like, this is so honest and so real and so, just immediately connects you with like why we're doing what we're doing, just like writing from such a raw, open, and vulnerable place. Meanwhile, I'm over here overthinking the thing to death before I even start writing, right? Like, I think remembering why we're doing what we're doing and why we were initially called to it is always a good idea.
It is, and it's true. That is what, you know, the writers who say, write what keeps you up at night. Well, what
Right.
kept her up at night was clearly, where's my cat?
100%, right? 100%. And I think the question, the am I enough, is what I have to say enough? Will people understand it? Like all of those questions that keep you from just like rawly expressing. And of course, like I'm on the other side of the coin, I'm not advocating for people to vomit something. I mean, I've seen that play too, where someone just like says exactly how they're feeling. It's like, get me the hell out of here. Why? You know, the audience is the most essential part of any play. So like craft your thing. But also I think, you know, being able to do both of those things, to craft your thing and to just be raw about how you're feeling. And if you can do both of those things, well, then you're doing it, you know? And then if you can figure out a way to share it, even better.
It's great. And when you it's funny, I'm thinking about Craft It, and when you think about rewriting now, because I think you talked earlier about your impulse, you know, and protecting that creative impulse, and you know, in the beginning. But now when you're listening to feedback or listening to a play in a new way, like you heard Reservoir in a new way, the Reservoir, what are you listening for, or what are you looking at for the rewriting process for you, once, you know, once you've cracked a play and you've got a draft and it's something to really work with?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big macro thing is trying to get enough distance from the thing to understand when it loses you, right? When am I tapping out on my own play? When am I bored by my own play, right? That's like the big thing. Or bored is not even right. When do I feel like there is something that gets me off of the energetic train of my play? I mean, I love working on my own plays in this way. I hate writing them. Like my first draft process is just, it's agonizing. And at Juilliard, you know, we have to write six first drafts in 2 years. And that process is just insane because it's just, I'm racked with doubt. But once I have the gesture, right, and the energetic thing, then it feels pretty, I've gotten better at understanding at least when I'm off that train. And so that's the big thing that I listen to. And then the second thing that I try to tap into is, am I trying to recreate the thing I had in my brain, or am I actually working on the thing that the director and the actors are working on right now? And I've seen a lot of playwrights really trip up on this. They're like, no, but I'm imagining it this way. It's like, well, but this is what's actually happening. These are the actual bodies in this space. So I always encourage myself, unless I'm in a situation in which I'm like, this director is just dead wrong, right? The most important part is to get the right collaborators in the room. But the thing that if you're doing that, and if on some level you know that you have done that, then I try to write towards what is actually being made as opposed to the thing that I was imagining in my room. So those are kind of the two big things that I tap into. And then also jokes, you know, like a big part of my work, even in, you know, I write comedies about things that aren't funny, right? I write a lot about addiction and memory loss and pain and all sorts of difficult and complicated things. But for me, my work, am I planting my laughs, is a big motivating force. And that I often cannot know until I have people delivering my lines. And I, like, there was, for example, in The Reservoir, there's this joke that I have at the beginning of the play. He's saying, when I get sober, I'm going to move back to New York and I'm going to write a harrowing rock opera about my alcoholism. And it's going to be called Rock Bottom. And I was like, that's funny, but I'm missing a part of the, it's not what I want the bottom to be a third. Cause right, that joke is funny cause it's rock bottom. And it's also like rock bottom, like it's, but then also I want it to be rock bottom, like gay. So I was like, oh, I need to say a gay harrowing rock opera, Rock Bottom. And then the joke killed, right? Like being able to just find those, the one word that will, you know, and I guess that's sort of more joke writing, but that's part of what I'm listening for as I'm writing a play.
Well, the joke writing, but also the specificness needed for a moment to land, whether it's a joke or the impact.
100%.
You know, good. And when you're going into those rooms with collaborators, or it's very funny, I was also thinking when you said you had to write six drafts, three a year for Juilliard. And what I think is interesting, there's this illusion that as you become a better writer, that each time you start a new play, you know how to write a play.
Oh, God.
And I know that there's the feeling of once you're staring at the blank page to start, you're like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. But what do you think you carry with you into the room or into the process now that you didn't, you know, 3, 7 years ago?
I think a greater understanding of structure, of what storytelling generally does, and even if I'm in opposition to some of that, just knowing sort of what my relationship to that is. I think I've slowly inched a little bit further towards faith that the thing is going to work out. You know, I think part of every theater process I've been in has been beginning to work on something, being like, what is this thing? We have no idea what it is. That's interesting. Wait a minute. The thing is coming up and we're nowhere near ready. Oh my God, the thing is bad. It's bad. It's really bad. They're not getting any better. Wait, they're getting a little bit better. There's an audience. It's great. Right. And like that whole just getting to do that, going on that emotional ride a bunch of times, has just given me a little bit more experience to be like, okay, I may feel completely out of control or have a lot of fears, and a lot of those fears just aren't true. And so I guess it's just trusting the process a little bit, and also trusting my plays, like trusting that, especially because when I shift from being like the wackadoo person who wrote the play to the very logical person who's rewriting the play, sometimes I'm like, oh, what was I trying to do here? I just worked on Spin, which is this play that I've been working on for a while that has this insane structure, and beyond that has a very specific tone of being like deeply sad and deeply funny. And when I set out to write that play, I knew that I wanted to write something that was discombobulating for folks. I knew that I didn't want to make something that people could totally understand what it was. I wanted it to be a little bit ah, but then in the room when I'm actually feeling that as the person working on it, I'm like, do they hate me? Do they hate it? Is it not working? And it's like actually being able to reconnect with the impulse and to believe in the thing that I have made, and to have enough faith that I've written enough that I know what I'm doing. Because sometimes actually you get into the room and you're like, this thing isn't working. And that's because it doesn't work. Like that also can happen. And that has happened. And that will continue to happen. But this is a long rant to say, I just think doing it more doing it more, writing more, producing more, finding ways to do more of it. You know, I think with a lot of playwrights who are just starting, they have feel like they have a great idea. I'm like, well, I actually don't think that great plays begin with great ideas. Like, great plays begin with great notions and great questions and great impulses and feelings in your body that you want to write into. Like, plays are found through the writing, plays are found through the working, plays are found through the dramaturgy. And getting, I feel like it's a tremendous privilege to have gotten to the point in which I've worked on plays enough that I have a little bit more space to believe that the thing will become what it needs to be.
Yeah, and I think I also resonated with that idea of the wackadoo creation and the rational rewriter, because and structure, because and I don't know if you start with structure in that wackadoo first draft, but I do. But I think trusting that you know how to make a how to shape a play after you've created a draft, I think that's really it's interesting. And then going back and listening to reminding yourself what was the origin, what were you trying to do, is those are it's good. Because but that rational rewriting is so interesting to me, because it is that's it, you know, you're listening to like how do I make this effective.
Something that I've been thinking a lot about too is just for me, and there are some people who don't feel this way, like the play happens in the audience, right? Like the play happens in the way that the audience experiences it and the things that surprise them and the things that feel both surprising and inevitable, and planting those and getting to experiment with like how are people listening. And with the Reservoir specifically, where I feel the most pride is when folks are just like, oh, and when they realize that something that I've planted early on is paying off in a way they didn't expect but makes so much sense. That to me also just feels like the North Star is the audience. The idea of what you are doing and why you are doing it and which order that it's in and the wording and the structure and the reordering, it's all to shape the audience's perception of the thing that you're making. And that feels like so obvious, but when most of our work that we are doing is in front of our computers, in our pajamas, and then if we're lucky, in a room of people sitting around a table, and then if we're really lucky, with some music stands in a room for theater people only, and then if we're really, really lucky, in a production, right? Like, I think we can lose track of that. Like, what are we actually trying to do? We're trying to create an experience in an audience. So I feel like if we remember that, then we're on the right track.
All those steps, and the hardest one to get to is the audience, you know, and which is why it's really important to share your play eventually in front of people who are not just your peers and friends, and not also only professional theater artists, you know, that you see that you're having
I
that
know.
impact. I do want to ask about. It's funny. I don't know if there's a question about the Reservoir happening, but there's a is there are regional productions going to happen in 25, right? 2025, and that are signed on. And it's just funny to say that. That's like, you know, we're new into 24, so those things were happening, and it's more than a year away that
I
that's
know.
going to happen. And it's thrilling that it's going to happen at these major institutions. And I think about earlier when you were saying the patience because of the scarcity of I got to get it up now, I got to get it up now. What is that? What is that experience for you like? I don't even know if I want to say emotionally or what, but just that idea of like, it's got to be a goal, you're right. You grew up in Denver. Your play's going to happen at the theater center. That's a big deal, right? It's the major theater from where you're from. I know what, you know, for me, I grew up in Rochester. If it was happening at Geneva, When I worked there, I thought, oh, I made it, and yet it's a year away. Yeah, what's the experience like for that versus I finished a draft, I'm putting up a reading on Monday.
Yeah, I mean it is a mind fuck. It's a mind fuck to have the thing that you wrote. I mean, when the play goes up, it'll be 5 years, right? Between the thing that I wrote and when it actually happens. And it is strange. It's strange to be like having the world experience your work on like a massive lag. The thing that I'm making now, I'm like, oh, okay, I guess this might be shared in 2030. I mean, literally, right? Like, and what does that mean? And I don't know if I have an answer to that, except for when I knew that the play was probably going to be programmed, I had 2+ years, and now we're at one. And in that time, I've been busy, and I think that that's really just what it comes down to, is like I could trip out on, oh my gosh, this is so hard and impossible. And even when it's going well, it's like years out. And will that happen? I mean, and I have all those fears, right? Like, what world will my play be crashing into? I mean, there's a broader question there about relevance. Like, if we're unable to meet the moment with theater, I think that's a problem. Like, we got to be able to do that. We got to be able to write plays that are relevant now. That being said, too, I think it's on the other side of the coin. Knowing that you're trying to write things that are universal, that are going to reach people no matter when they're written, is also a clarifying force sometimes. And ultimately, I can do some hustling around like, please produce my play, but mostly all I can do is like, what is interesting to me now? What is gnawing at me? What do I have inside to say? How do I say it as best as I can? And then how do I start these balls moving? How do I radically believe in these things without being like an egomaniac, right? How do I say, I know this will be something because I feel it, without being like my least favorite person in the world, who's like, my terrible thing is great, So, yeah, it's a roller coaster. I mean, I think I challenge you to find me the playwright who is like 100% mentally well in this moment, right? Like, everyone is kind of a mess because our industry is a mess, and this thing that was like impossible is getting even more impossible. Understanding how to support oneself, understanding how to share the work that feels the most pressing, all of those questions are super difficult. For better or for worse, I feel a lot of safety and love in the decision that I've made to pursue something so stupid, something so impossible, something that I know is not going to make me much money, no matter how successful I am at it. Because I just love it more than anything in the whole wide world. And knowing that that's the decision I've made actually helps me sleep at night, weirdly. Sorry, you ask about my emotional state, and I could go on for years, Patrick. I do my therapy on Zoom. I'm ready for this.
Well, I'm not going to go into therapy. I'm going to take the gear about doing something you love and recognizing the potential for financial security in that field. And all the great things you talked about your process, I would love to ask, what advice do you have when you think about it? When you think about either starting this career or people who have done the 7 years of time that you put in at one point, and what is your advice to people pursuing this?
Well, I mean, a couple things from a purely pragmatic angle, finding the day job, finding the income stream that allows you to write. I mean, that would be my big thing. I work as a birthday party clown, sort of an 11th hour admission, but on the weekends, and it's Saturdays and Sundays, and it like ends up being 12 to 13 hours a day, like big days. But I only work for the last since 2015, I've worked 2 days a week, and I've had 5 days a week to write, and I figured out how to hack that. So I think finding that is incredibly important, or at least finding the day job that allows enough soul space to write. And then a couple other things, like one is something that I alluded to earlier, which is that fixate on your ideas. Like writing is found through the writing. That's my experience, is when I feel like I've had a really good idea that can actually be paralyzing. And I've also met people who have been trying to write and rewrite the same play over and over and over and over again. Like literally, I mean, all playwrights write the same play over and over again, but I mean literally, like they're writing the same first scene of their play until they think it's perfect. It's like you're never going to get anywhere. Like you probably need to write seven shitty plays before you write a good one. Also, something that I'm really tripping out on lately is your body, right? I feel like often, you know, we're working on an embodied medium, right? And playwrights are often really like trapped inside their heads. And so finding ways to like really get your plays into your body and understand sort of what impulses might be coming for your body, that gets me, that's very Colorado woo-woo. But it's something that I've been thinking about, especially with folks who want to do things that don't look like other things that they've seen, is that actually feeling your plays at times, I feel like has for me unlocked things. I have more advice if you want more. I could go forever. It's really just giving advice to myself, though.
Yeah, what does it mean to get into your body? What does that, get your play into your body? What does that look like for you?
So one of my big moments was in 2012, I was a musical theater student at NYU, and I transferred into the experimental theater wing. And I was also like, I was an alcoholic disaster, which I can say now because the play that's being done is all about that. I had no idea who I was in the world, and I was trying to figure it out. And I took Grotowski with Erika Fay, Grotowski was this Polish man who championed an idea of physical work that is sort of like embodied consciousness, is like shapes that you can sort of use to sort of play with imagery and your train of thought. And getting into my body that way. And, you know, I was never a very coordinated person. So it wasn't about movement or dance or shapes of like trying to like aspire to something. It's more about understanding sort of how to process oneself through your body, right? In sort of a yogic way. Obviously very different than that, but I think that's a way in that people can sort of understand, like, what does it mean to find peace through your body? And this is more like, what does it mean to find consciousness through your body? And for me, that just opened up a world of being like, oh, I actually have a lot to share that I can't figure out, and that I need my body in order to express those things. And flash forward, I've been working with her ever since and have begun to sort of develop physical dramaturgy practices, which is like asking sort of how can playwrights use their bodies to unblock themselves and to write plays and to develop structures. And spin, which is my batshit reincarnation Jewish owl play, was definitely born from Grotowski plastic river of just like a self-induced physical acid trip of being like, wouldn't it be cool if this connected to this, if this connected to this, and this connected to this, and then writing from that impulse, as opposed to I want to write a play about two people in Denver at the turn of the century or something, right? That's very much, and as someone who is from a very like thinky family, you know, Jewish folks who are lawyers and doctors, to be able to be like, oh, I can be my metaphysical trippy self and this can unlock things for me, was a huge moment. Yeah, I could talk about that forever, but I do think oftentimes playwriting can trap people in their heads, and it's like the worst place for someone to be when they're trying to do this specific thing.
Yeah, when you're trying to do something creative and also not in that particular play, non-linear, you know,
right
thing. And I'm very interested into the physical, and we don't have to keep talking about advice, but if, yeah, when you said I have tons of it and I could talk all day, yeah, I'm interested because I'm really, you know, having met you in 2011, just the creativity, there was no doubt, right? But I'm proud of the trajectory of the art and the career. And I'm like, and I think there is a community of people who work with you and have been around you that are like, oh, I want that too. And, you know, how does it happen? you know, or what do you suggest? And I also think what's interesting, how does it happen? I asked that question. I'm like, there's no one path. I know
There
that.
is no one path.
But no, it's great to talk. And I also was really glad to hear, because when I researched your website today and you talked about the Kratowski traumaturgy, I meant to ask about it. So I'm really glad you got to talk about it, because I know it's real.
Yeah. I mean, I love that work. I love anything that sort of gets me out of trying to figure out something that I'll never be able to figure out, right? Which is like, feels like recovery work, and feels like that work, anything that sort of allows me to ask more questions than to search for more answers, has been a propulsive force in my creative life. And oftentimes I think in things like this, when I want to get advice, or when I'm asking for advice, like, you know, David and Tanya at Juilliard, who have careers, I mean, that are incredible. You'll ask questions and, you know, they'll pause and be like, I don't, you know, their paths are so singular. Like, nobody has an answer, right? Nobody has the thing that you can do to get to where you want to go. And even looking back on sort of like how I've stumbled into having a little bit more traction, it's so random and chaotic and weird and you know, just truly random. And yet I can trace it all back to the fact that I've remained genuinely curious about what I want, about, you know, and not all the time, but most of the time, and have kept trying to ask questions and write things that are just a little bit beyond me, and create traps for myself. You know, something that I've also done is writing, I'll have dinner parties that I plan, and I'll say, we're reading my new play on December 12th. Everyone come on over. I'm making latkes. And I have not written a goddamn word, right? Like, and it'll be 4 weeks from now. Like, I'll set traps for myself, or I'll set creative traps. I'll say, with spin or with something, I'll be like, what if I wrote something that jumped around in time radically? And can I pull that off, right? And created something that I feel in my body that I have something to offer around, but I don't know exactly what it is yet. And I think something that I felt, and I was wrong about when I started, was like, oh, I'll know exactly what I want to do, and then I'll do it. And it's like, I just don't know any good piece of art that's been made that way. So having the humility and the confidence to be like, I'm going to try something, let's see how it goes. I think if you're on that mission and you keep returning to it, and you want things to be better and funnier and weirder and more special, that you'll get to where you want to go. I hope, you know, check in with me next year.
Thank you, Jake. Thank you for the conversation. It was great. And I hope, maybe I'll write it down and we'll check in a year from now and see if that holds true. You know, I loved the whole thing, said how he's listening to the play and ways in which he's trusting collaborators, and about putting the right collaborators, people you trust, in a room together, and trusting that they're working on something, that they're all working towards something, and listening to that process and not trying to control it or hold on to what the exact first impulse is, but what's actually happening. And I think that's really interesting, because I find it to be true. And one of the things that stops us from growing artistically is trying to hold on to, like, well, this is what it is, or what it was, or what I, and it really gets expansive. And I think that's it's great to hear, because I think it's important to collaborate that way. And also, I also liked the idea of him sharing that he's a birthday clown, because I had a couple of conversations lately with the idea of finding a way, and I know that I did it early on in my career, that financially you can be secure and allow you to do your art. And, you know, I think that's foundational, important, you know, information to have. It's like, right, you want to be secure so that you can create and pursue what you want to do. And eventually, hopefully, the creative pursuit becomes the thing that gives you foundational support. And we also had the conversation mentioned how challenging that is long-term anyways, but really proud of Jake's success and growth. also thinking that him and Aaron Mallon are the two college playwrights I've talked with. I'm not should probably do that more because it's fun to watch how that's taking off, how their careers continue to grow. And I'm thinking we just kicked off. Enid Graham had a conversation with the two schools already, and they're starting to write their play. Third production of Dipti's play, The Ruminants, is happening at Middle Tennessee. And just excited about that process and watching this, just because when Jake mentioned the multiple development opportunities and how rare that is, I was thinking, you know, he's had four developments with the Sloan Commission, The Reservoir, but also three productions of the play before that with Our Tempest. And it is great because I think taking that time and having long-term commitment to development is what allows people to have patience in their process and not have to activate out of a scarcity mentality. So I'm really, really glad to hear how that thought process is changing and the thought process, emotional, psychological experience is happening in his process of creating work. So yeah, thanks for listening, and always share with us any thoughts, anything that's happening with you. I'm happy to pitch it out, promote it socially in our newsletter, and you know, just building community as we keep, as I keep stressing, that is key. So with that, we're out.